We talked last night about developing a framework for thinking and suggested there that godly wisdom or proper thinking makes possible godly discernment. We want to involve ourselves with people with the right passion. We want to discern what needs to be looked at. And tonight I want to think a little bit about procedure or method. With our passions thought through a little bit, we check out our passions as we sit down with somebody. What are we really committed to? What are we trying to accomplish? What's happening within us? How are we coming across? What passions are energizing us? How is the wasp at work, even as we counsel? Question one. Question two, what are we calling the problem? What are we observing? What are we seeing? We want to discern the things that need to be discerned. And then, lastly, tonight, godly procedures. Let me just bring us back to pace, to speed, where we've been, and reintroduce something we've used a couple nights just to get us back where we want to be tonight. A familiar diagram we've looked at several times. That's not going to work. There we go. And what I've said so far, just to very, very briefly review, is that we need to develop some passionate convictions about our purpose, which can be summarized very, very simply by saying that we're not involved in using God to solve problems. We're rather involved in using problems as an impetus and as a reason to find God. In terms of developing passionate convictions about the fallen structure, we developed that little model, beginning with doubting God, because that's what started in the Garden of Eden, and suggested some categories for listening as we think through people's lives so we can have greater insight as people are telling us their stories. We need some understanding. And now our concern is with procedure. And I want to suggest that you and I need to enter the story of people. And that's my theme for tonight. What does it mean to enter someone's story? Counseling is really not a whole lot more than storytelling. Counseling isn't a whole lot more than storytelling. Everybody's life is a story. It's the story of self in relationship. Hell might be defined as self without relationship. And our concern is to help people tell their stories of who they are in relationship, ultimately with God. As we work with people to get them to enter, to get them to tell their stories, as we enter their story, I'm suggesting that we need to depart from what is done, in my judgment, maybe 90% of counselors' offices. We need to not do what is commonly done, one of four things. This is still review. Nothing new here yet. We need to not do what is commonly done. We need to not move into people's lives with the idea of fixing something. We're not to move into people's lives with the idea of getting rid of something. We're not to move into folks' lives, I suggest, with the idea of merely soothing something. Nor are we to move into people's lives with the idea of coercing something. You hear in those comments the four models Dan talked about. Rather, what we're wanting to do is to enter people's stories, enter their lives, with hope in Christ that provides rest. That's a good little summary sentence. We're to enter people's lives, hear their stories, providing hope in Christ that provides rest. All psychological problems can ultimately be traced back to scrambling as opposed to resting. There's something that's happened in my existence and in your existence that has alerted me to a danger that I must stay away from. I must defend against it. I must scramble in the middle of a hostile world with a deficient self to make my life work. I'm always scrambling. I'm always working. I'm strategizing. I'm a chess player who's trying to figure out my next move so I can win the game. I'm always scrambling. And because of the scrambling, the result is going to be a variety of problems. We need to enter people's lives, enter their stories, providing hope in Christ in a way that provides rest, not solutions to their problems, but rather rest in the middle of their problems. Problems you will always have with you. If I could get that one point across this week, I think that I'd be really pleased. I'm not concerned whether you agree, but I'm concerned that you hear. You may disagree, and that's okay. But I really want you to hear what I'm saying, that the central point, for me at least, of the week, is that we're not trying to get rid of problems. We're not trying to solve problems. We're trying to enter people's stories to provide the hope of Christ at very deep levels that will deal with the energy of Cain in a way that will minimize the scrambling and introduce a concept of rest where no matter what continues to go on in my life, no matter how my relationship with this person might be difficult, no matter how bad the marriage might be, no matter how scared I am of what's happening in my kids' lives, no matter what's going on in my soul, no matter what's going on in my circumstances, there's a foundation of rest that allows me to move into my life with wisdom and power and courage. Problems may remain, but my usefulness to the kingdom will increase. And which do I want, usefulness or fewer problems? Biblical counseling is radically different from secular counseling, primarily in its agenda. As I listen to you tell your story, as you listen to me tell my story, there are two things you're wanting to do primarily. And this has been the theme of the morning sessions to at least some degree. The two things you're wanting to do as you listen to me tell my story is to introduce some level of disruption that's productive. What are you trying to disrupt? I want to answer that question tonight in the course of our evening. Exactly what is it we're trying to disrupt? Our process of change is disrupting something that leads to a strong productivity. Something good happens because of the disruption. In the middle of the disruption, something becomes visible that can be affirmed. In the middle of disrupting the junk, in the middle of disrupting the energy behind the scrambling, in the middle of disrupting those things that are causing problems, in the middle of disrupting all those things that reflect the energy of Cain, when disruption becomes significant, what you find in the heart of a believer is something surfaces that's worth enticing and affirming. There is a new heart. There are legitimate longings in the core of the soul that can be enticed, affirmed, encouraged. I'm all for affirmation, but just not of the wrong thing. And I'm concerned about the timing of affirmation. It must follow disruption. I want to suggest that when people come in to chat with us or over lunch, whatever the setting might be, that one of the great struggles of counseling, one of the great tasks of the counselor, one of the great skills of the counselor, and here's where some technique training would not be inappropriate. It's how to take the person, let me put the overhead back on just for a minute. It's how to take the person from the presenting problem to telling their story. That's something we're not going to say much about, but that's something that you want to ponder a great deal. All the work down here, the purpose, that's done between you and the Lord. Your understanding of the fallen structure, that's something which you ponder, which you study, which you think about, and you learn the fallen structure primarily by studying Scripture as you look in the mirror. The log out of your own eye. Then you see clearly, Matthew says, into the plank in somebody else's. The process of change, that's a theoretical construct in your mind. The actual visible work on counseling, what you see on tape, is on top here. The presenting problem is stated and the story is told. That's all you watch on tape. When you see Dan and I interact about the counseling session, you hear us talking down at these lower levels. What's our purpose? What's the structure going on inside of the clients? What do we see as the process of change? What is the disruption we're trying to introduce? What is it that we're trying to affirm? That's what's happening down beneath the surface. But in terms of method, in terms of procedure, when a presenting problem gets stated, the major job of the counselor, and it's not an easy one, is to move from presenting problem to telling the story. Now let me just say just a sentence or two about that. That deserves a whole lecture, and I'm not going to give it. But a sentence or two about it would be, look, whatever the person presents as their problem, look to see whatever natural context that problem occurs in. The man says, I'm so discouraged with my work. I just am getting so depressed. I'm not sure if I should change my job or not. I think I'm just losing all motivation. I'm losing all steam. Your friend tells you over lunch. And that's the presenting problem. I don't like my job anymore. I really hate it. I don't feel fulfilled. I'm getting bored out of my mind. I can't stand my colleagues. And I'm not sure what else to do with my life. I feel like I'm in a midlife crisis. Presenting problem. How do you shift from presenting problem to where we think the action is, telling the story? And why is it the action there? Because telling the story of the person's relationships will most clearly reveal the fallen structure that you have your yellow marker out to highlight. Getting all this? Following the thread of it? Is it hanging together a little bit for you? I see six heads nodding. That's a thrill. It beats the average. As the person presents their problem, I have this job difficulty, and you want to get them over here because you're thinking about the fallen structure, and you're wanting to surface between the two of you whatever it is that's going on in this person's soul that reflects the wasp, the energy of Cain, that is getting in the way of this man pursuing God with vigor in the middle of his job situation, believing that if he's doing that, then wisdom will be granted to deal with the specifics of what's happening. Your primary job is to encourage the pursuit of God, because that's what you're after. Your diagnosis is not, gee, should he change jobs? Your diagnosis is rather what's going on in his soul that's keeping him from knowing God more deeply in the middle of this mess. You're not solving problems. You're using problems to find God. Therefore, you talk about his story. How do you get there as he presents his problem? It's real simple if I give one illustration. It's real simple. You say something like, tell me when you talk about this with your wife, how do the conversations go? Now you're into the story of his relationship, or at least an entrance to the story of his relationship. Who else have you talked about this with? Tell me where else in your life you felt frustration. Tell me where you felt similar kinds of feelings in your life. Tell me who has been an encouragement to you in situations like this. A lot of questions that must come out of your artistry, an artistry that's based on your convictions about what needs to be done. Now, as the person begins telling their story, and I spend not much time on that, primarily because there's one sense in which it really isn't hard to get a person to tell their story, because all of us want to. That's why Cheers has run so long on television. A place where, what's the opening jingle? How's the jingle go? Everybody knows your name. And you can kind of go in there and tell your story. You get kind of demeaned a little bit here and there. But when somebody's interested, people like to talk. And do you realize that most everybody in the world has a tremendous fear of being boring? What a shame that you have to pay somebody to listen to you for an hour. If we in the church knew how to listen, then a lot of good things could happen with a little less expense involved, maybe. I'm scared of being boring. You're scared of being boring. But if I show that I'm really interested in your life and have real compassion and find you fascinating, find you very intriguing, and believe that you're a very important part of God's plan, and I'd love to have the privilege of lifting your story up into the larger story of God. If that's the energy coming out of me, not trying to heal, help, explain, control, be right, get you to belong without shame, but if I have a passion within me that wants to really enter your story and to do what I can to lift you up to the larger story of God, chances are, you're going to eventually want to talk. Remember, one of the strangest situations I ever had in my counseling ministry was a woman years ago in my practice in Boca Raton who came to see me. She was maybe 25 years old, living at home, and she was brought by her parents, and she was sat in my office, and she sat there for the first three or four sessions, literally, and did not say a word for three or four sessions. She was psychotic. And she sat there and just did this the whole time. I mean, what do you do for three or four sessions? How do you get folks to tell you their story when they just sit there and look like that? And all I did was try to show a deep interest in her and begin to say, I don't believe that you're unable to hear me. And my guess is there's something inside of you that would love to burst out and connect with someone. Maybe you'll give me that privilege. Maybe you won't. Either way, I'm going to pray for you. And I would pray for her while she sat there. She wouldn't move. She didn't close her eyes. She just kept on. I'd kind of peek, you know. And then I would do things, and sometimes I'd just read a book for a while, but never in a rude kind of a way. I'd say, I really want you to know this book will go down as soon as you want to chat. But in the meantime, I'll read a book, and then I'll kind of look up at you and see if anything's happening that I can figure out. And I'd look up now and then, and I'd maybe see a little movement of the head, and I'd say, I wonder if that movement of the head meant something. You really want to talk, I bet. My guess is you're lonely. I don't know a thing about your family, but I met your mother and father as they brought you in. They seem like very harsh people. I wonder if you're really scared of me. And I went on like that for four or five sessions, intermittently reading, talking, four or five sessions, literally. Fifth session, She, as we were sitting there and I'm doing this thing, she got up from the sofa in which she was sitting, went to my desk and got a piece of paper and got a pencil. And in the corner of the paper, she wrote with a pencil in letters that were so small I could barely read them. She wrote a word and handed it to me. I took it and I read the word. It was lesbian. And I began talking about how shameful you must feel. And I want you to understand that I believe you're a woman of value that God loves. And I'd love the privilege of chatting. 8-10 more sessions, and she finally began talking. That took a long time. Sometimes it's hard to get folks to tell you the story. And sometimes, even though it's not as hard as in that obviously difficult and traumatic way, certainly there are people who, when they begin telling their story, don't get to the point. And frankly, a lot of people, when they don't get to the point, really are boring. And what you have to do is make the assumption that if they're boring, they're covering something up, because nobody's story is boring. So you assume that. And if that's your energy, sometimes people will begin telling you their story. And as they tell you their story, I suggest that your job is to enter the story. Entering the story means so much more than what beginning counselors usually think it means. Entering the story means so much more than just sitting there and grunting with compassion. Really? Oh. You know, people make a living doing that. It's amazing. Listening to stories involves the hard work of moving into another person's life for the purposes of connection and release, disruption and affirmation. And as people begin telling you their stories and say, well, yeah, the job problems are real tough, and, you know, my wife, she just, well, I don't know, man, I'm married to her for now 15, 18 years, whatever, I forget what it is, you know, I don't even care anymore, I suppose. She just wants to spend money, and I'm not making enough, and I felt pressure from her for years. Can't believe it. What would you say next if the guy told you that over lunch? It all depends on what you're listening for. I suggest you listen to how they're telling their story. There are five ways. I suggest you listen to how they're telling their story. Don't listen merely to the content. It's too easy to listen to the content only and say, well, have you tried this? Have you gone to your wife and told her more honestly? Look, honey, I really find that you're not supportive here, and I don't think you've heard how struggling I really am. I mean, I want to tell you, this is tough, and I don't know why you're so unsupportive. Wish you could be a little more supportive of me. Have you tried telling her that? And a lot of beginning counselors give quick advice, and it's always, almost always, dismissed by the counselee saying, oh, yeah, I tried that, it didn't work. And the counselor goes, and they try some other advice that doesn't work, and they never come back to see you for counseling, and you wonder if you're cut out for the business, and you probably aren't if that's how you counsel. So do something different. Start listening differently to the ways people tell their stories. I want to suggest there are five ways. Let me just take it off and let you see all five at once here. There are five ways that people tell their stories. There may be other ways to look at it. This is my suggestion. Five ways to tell your story. People can tell their story as a tragedy, or they see themselves as a victim of life, but they're coping nobly. People can tell their stories as a romance. I'm finding myself. Aren't you excited? People can tell their stories as an irony, a cynic continuing. Oh yeah, life isn't worth much, but hey, what the heck, I'll make it. I can't stand my wife, but you know what? I mean, I'm in a church. I'm not going to dump her or anything like that. Not much point to anything, but we're doing all right. People can tell their stories as a comedy, a fool laughing. Things are great, right? Not his problems, but hey, you know, everybody's got problems. I mean, we're doing fine. I can whistle as I walk past the graveyard. Or people can tell their stories in the way that I'm obviously going to suggest is a good way to tell them. The first four have their problems. The fifth I'm suggesting is good. A transcendent drama. An image bearer struggling to trust and rejoicing when he does. An image bearer struggling to trust and rejoicing when he does. Listen, I'm suggesting, not only for the categories that a fallen structure suggests. Do more than merely get out your yellow marker and highlight those elements that reflect the fallen structure, the operation of Cain's energy within the human soul. Listen for that, but listen for more. Listen not only for categories or structure, but also listen for style. What is the style with which they tell their story? Five styles I'm suggesting here. Let me go over all that I've just said and add just a thought or two now that you have it written down and you can ponder as I chat for a minute. As someone begins telling their story and you listen to them tell their story of their present relationships, they over time begin telling the story of their background and how they were raised and how they had to move 10 times because their father's work was unstable and there was no money and they had to go where the money was. As they tell their stories, there's a lot of ways to tell them. The first way I'm suggesting that they can tell their stories as a tragedy. And think, is this the way you tell your story? Is this the attitude that we have towards our lives as we think about the way God is preserving our story? Do we see ourselves as caught up in the middle of a tragedy in the sense of, I'm merely a victim who's having to cope with all these hard things in my life? Listen to the style. Is that the mood with which they're saying it? That's going to reflect a lot about the person that you're going to want to point out. If they're telling their story as a tragedy, they're saying things like, I'll make it, with a big sigh. What's the pull of a person telling their story as a tragedy? What are they looking for? What are they pulling from you, would you suggest? Sympathy, affirmation, encouragement. You can tell if the person's telling their story as a tragedy by what you feel like doing, what you're pulled by them to do. Are you always pulled to encourage these folks who are just struggling so hard? Let me sound very harsh and unkind. I hope I don't mean it that way. But let me use a very negative, pejorative sounding word. These are the people that we sometimes, in slang phrase, call leeches on the counseling profession in the extreme form. Not a person in this world hasn't, in this room certainly, hasn't told some of their story in tragic terms. And basically presented ourselves as a victim of all these unfair things. Look at all the injustice. Look at all that's happened to me. I've been hurt so badly. Somebody ought to come along and do something for me. What's that person's ruling passion? What is their style of relating? How are they manipulating their world? I'll make it, with a big sigh. A lot of self-pity, a lot of false nobility. Noticing the style of the story gives you a great deal of insight into style of relating, into pull, into ruling passion. Suppose the person tells their story as a romance. And what excites them more than anything else is how they're coming alive. Anything wrong with the joy of coming alive? Of course not. Once I was blind, but now I see. Mary and Martha, my brother was dead, now he's alive. Anything wrong with rejoicing over that? Of course not. But what happens, largely out of the recovery movement in today's culture, is that the final value is personal aliveness. And I tell my story in romantic terms, saying, yes, there's problems, and yes, there's been tragedies, and I've coped, but I've learned to set my boundaries, and now I exist, praise God. Nothing matters more than my existence. I'm emerging. I'm somebody. Here I am. Wow. It's hard to square that with John the Baptist. He must increase. What does he mean there? I must decrease. A lot of pride in the romantic tale. I believe that give the recovery movement another couple of years and we'll see I think we're already seeing it. We'll see a sweep of narcissism fill our churches like it never seen before. I talked to a chaplain at the last advanced seminar that we had in April, the version of this one we had last April, and a college chaplain actually told me that he had had a number of interactions with college students to the point where it had become a pattern he felt that he was discerning. And the pattern was this, that these college students had parents who were in the recovery groups learning to emerge, to set their boundaries so they could take care of themselves and be all that they could be. And in many cases, their emergence did involve the dropping off of certain addictive behaviors. Dad was no longer drinking, mom was no longer gambling, and they were now whole people who were rejoicing in their newfound health. But what the chaplain observed was the student said, but even though they've gotten better, gotten better by their terms, and a person has emerged, I have no more desire to go home for Christmas than I did when they were still drinking. And the chaplain was puzzled by this because you don't want to go home to a dad who's drinking all the time and who gets drunk and embarrasses your friends and gets to be a bully and has a mean drunk. You don't want to go home to that. Well, now he's no longer a drunk, but they don't want to go home any more than they did before. And the question, as the chaplain asked why, the answer was because they don't care about me any more than they did when they were drinking. A person emerging. But is love developing? As I talk about the romance, I suggest that there's a great deal of narcissism and pride and the person who tells their story as a romance, where they are center stage actor or actress. I'm not the center stage in the important story of life. I'm a bit player. I'm a player, but I'm not center stage. And when I tell my story, the most natural thing is for me to be center stage. Folks, that really is pride. That really is the worst of all sins. That really is at the root of all of our problems. I wonder how I'll leave feeling after this advanced seminar. I'll tell you, one man will leave feeling is tired. And so will you. What do you suppose I'm feeling as I watch two people that I really respect? I don't know them very well, but little I know, Reggie's a good guy and Mike's a good guy. And I thought their skit was funny. I thought it was in good taste. I just enjoyed it. I thought it was great. But Reggie was impersonating me. And where's that put the spotlight, do you suppose? I wonder how Dan felt. Am I opposed to skits? Please don't hear this as anything along that line. That was funny, and I'd do it again. It was great. But even the good things of life create struggles in the human soul. I wonder if I'm going to think of this in the advanced seminar, in parts of it at least, in terms of romantic terms, where I stood forth. When folks say, how did it go? Back at school, I get to Denver tomorrow, and friends say, how did that seminar go? Where's my mind going to automatically go? To how I did? Did I come alive and do pretty good? A lot of us are romantic in that awful sense, aren't we? Third kind of story is an irony. A cynic continuing. The cynic who looks at life and who gets a little richer taste of life, a little more maturity here in some ways, because the cynic sees that life really doesn't work. He faces the dilemma of existence. He knows that no matter how much he helps somebody, there's still a whole lot more to go. Pretty hard to be a counselor for long without brushing up against cynicism. Because have you noticed nobody changes all that much? Real change takes a long time, have you noticed? Exodus 23, when God was speaking to the Israelites, and he said, when you go into the land, you're going to defeat the enemy, but you're going to do it slowly, little by little. Deuteronomy 3, it says that you'll defeat the enemy, you'll do it quickly. A contradiction in the Bible? Looks like it, but it's not. Because in Exodus 23, God is saying that the enemies you're going to defeat slowly are all the little enemies. The Hittites, the Jebusites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, all these different ites that were in the land of Canaan that the Jews were going to have, the Hebrews were going to have to go in and destroy to take over the land. And God says, all those little problems that are there, I'm going to give you a long time to take care of. And in Deuteronomy 3, he says, you're going to have quick victory, but talking now not about the lesser enemies, but about the giants in the land. Remember the spies went in, they came back in Numbers, 13, somewhere in there? The spies came back and they said that we got big problems here, folks. They got a whole lot of enemies, but then we have the big ones. And God says, you'll handle the big ones quickly, and the little ones you'll handle real slowly. You read the history of Joshua, and what you find is the Hebrews spent 7 years dealing with the little ones. After 7 years, Caleb comes along and knocks off the giants in a day, quickly. What's the lesson? You got a big problem? Struggling with homosexuality? Struggling with depression? Eating disorders? You tackle the big problem right away, chances are you'll fail. Deal with all the little ways, all the little foxes that spoil the vines. Deal with all the little things in your life, all the ways you relate, all the jealousies you haven't dealt with, all the ways you pull for affirmation. You deal with all that, and it takes you a long time, and the other problem doesn't seem to go away, disappear. It's just as big as ever. You hate it, and it goes on for years and years and years and years and years. As you keep on working at these small, low problems, there's not much victory. Things aren't happening very well. And then as a good friend of mine told me this week, he feels after years of working on the lesser problems, there's a breakthrough coming. Lose perspective on all that and see only the length of time it takes for any meaningful growth to take place, and you too might become a cynic. But you'll hang in there, you know. Give me plan B. What else am I good at? You know, if I leave the counseling field, I'm not good at anything else. Guess I'll stay with this. What the heck? I'll be all right, you know. I'll make it. I'm tired, but I'll do a couple more seminars. A cynic, continuing. Who really gives a rip? Some of you are there right now, pastors. A lot of pastors are there. I don't say it unkindly, I say it with great compassion, because I'm there a lot too. And the emotion beneath that is not the self-pity and the sense of nobility of the tragic storyteller. Not the pride and narcissism of the romantic storyteller, but the emotion that's there in the ironic storyteller is rage. Pure, unadulterated, bitter, resentful rage. Some folks tell their story in a comedy form. Fools laugh when there's no reason to laugh. G.K. Chesterton tells that as he reads the story of the towering figure of the Gospels, that the one emotion that you don't see in our Lord, that he believes is being hidden from us, not that it's not there, it's just held back, is the laughter of our Lord. He has a sentence in his book, The Romance of Orthodoxy, where he says that heaven's laughter is too loud for us to hear. But the laughter of heaven, not the laughter of fools. There's no fool's paradise in heaven. That's real paradise, where laughter makes sense. Lewis's phrase is one of my favorites. The serious business of heaven is joy. The fool is one who laughs because he hasn't faced reality. He hasn't found that beneath the horror of reality, there really is reason to laugh. He doesn't go far enough. He maintains what I very pejoratively, forgive me, call the country club mentality. Everything's fine. I'm doing all right. Things are great. Life's a bowl of cherries. I got no problems. If I have a problem, I'll just go somewhere else and not think about it. A fool laughs. What's his emotion? His emotion isn't self-pity, as the tragic storyteller. His emotion is not pride or narcissism, as the romantic storyteller. His emotion is not rage, as the ironic storyteller. His deep emotion, which if you can get to as a counselor, you've made incredible headway, is a terror of depth. A terror of depth. Rachel and I were on a cruise years ago. We lived in Florida. And there was a very wealthy, retired, older couple who were on this cruise. And we struck up a bit of a relationship. And one night I was standing on the deck next to the railing, beautiful night in the Atlantic Ocean. I got talking with this older gentleman who was filthy rich, and I'm just sociable conversation, talking at the level of superficiality, which is what you do to make chit-chat, you know, with folks you meet on cruises. Cruises are wonderful at superficial chit-chat. And I, you know, what'd you do in retired? What was your work? And do you like cruises? Do you often come on them? He says, yeah, about once every 2 months. We take about a week. Oh. And I saved up for a year to afford this three-day thing. And, well, yeah, I got money more than I know what to do with. And I remember I began moving a little bit towards some level of depth, and I said, do you enjoy them? No. Kills time. And he looked out over the waters, and I could have disappeared as far as he was concerned, and I wish I could recall his exact words. I can't. But there was something along the line of nothing means anything. Here's a man who all his life had been a fool who was laughing. And at some point, depth is required of you. And you're bankrupt. You have nothing. A fool who spends his life saying there's no reality beneath the surface that needs to be looked at. May I say it kindly? A lot of young people are really stuck there. I don't believe you should take away the joys of adolescence and tell our teenage children that sit them down and go through every horrible scenario we can think of as to how life is going to foul up for them. I'm not thinking that's necessarily wise. But I sure think that there need to be ways in which at all levels, whether 5 years old or 20 years old or 50, or at all levels, there needs to be some way of introducing the fact that there's more to think about than you're thinking about right now. And while it's terrifying and scary, if you're willing to go into it, you'll feel like your very soul is being ripped out of you, but beneath that, you will land squarely on God. And you'll laugh, the laugh of the redeemed, on the other side of pain. The last way of telling the story is a transcendent drama. And that's very different than the first four. The last one is no longer saying, oh, I'll make it. I'm a victim, but I'll make it. He's not saying, here I am, aren't you impressed? He's not saying, who gives a rip like the cynic does. He's not saying, things are great, right, like the comic does. The transcendent drama storyteller is one who his fundamental theme is, look what's ahead. It's unbelievable. That's transcendence in drama. My life is fitting into a larger picture. Everything in the universe is in motion. God is telling his story, and I've been lifted up into transcendence. Folks, if you want to give your kids the biggest gift you can give them the gift of transcendence. That you're aware of another dimension. Lewis called it the shadows, which speak of the reality which we have yet to see. My life is a drama being lived out at a transcendent level that I can't see, but I believe, and I know the anchor point, I know what's ahead. The last advanced seminar, Dan said something I'll never forget. He was talking about reading novels, and he said that he's the kind of reader of novels who insists, I don't think he said it this semester, this seminar, if he did, forgive me for repeating it, I recall it last April. He said, when I read novels, I'm the kind of novel reader who always reads the last chapter first. You know? And then he said, that's biblical. Hear the point? He that hath this hope in you, look what's ahead, purifies himself now. My life is different to the degree that I'm aware of what yet is to come. If in this life only we have hope in Christ, eat, drink, and be merry. Why not? Do you want to have an affair? I can't think of a good reason not to. Well, it worked better to stay married to your wife than having an affair. Fine, if that's what suits your taste. Whatever suits your taste. Unless Christianity's true. Then is whatever suits his taste, because one day you'll realize that really is your taste too. So you conform to his idea, a transcendent drama, struggling in the middle of life's difficulties, struggling when everything goes wrong, struggling when a job is lost, struggling when money is gone, struggling when health is taken, struggling when loved ones die, struggling when symptoms come into your life, you can't figure them out, struggling when urges come into your soul, and you just wish you didn't have those miserable sexual urges that just drive you and haunt you all the time. In the middle of all that, struggling to trust
God, you're still good. You got a plan. I'm going to honor you. I'm going to resist doing what's wrong. I'm going to keep on doing what's right to the best of my ability. When I fail, I'm going to celebrate forgiveness. When I have victory, I'm going to celebrate your power. I'm going to trust you, God, in the middle of all this somehow. And those times when trust seems to become a reality, and they're serendipitous, those times when trust seems to become a reality, and somehow I'm lifted up to something higher, then you just want to sing. Then you rejoice. Then you have your moments where worship is in no way contrived. It flows. Listen to a man or woman tell the story of their transcendent drama, and you'll be drawn to worship. That'll be the pull. You'll not be pulled to take care of the poor victim. You'll not be pulled to affirm the emerging person and to rejoice with their newfound self-esteem. You'll not be pulled to somehow join them in their rage and say, yeah, life really stinks, but we'll plod along together. You'll not be pulled to stay superficial and to avoid depth because they couldn't handle it. Those are the pulls of the four stories. You'll be pulled to worship when you hear someone tell their stories of transcendent drama. As people tell their stories, listen to how they're told. And there's a mixture. I'm not saying that everyone's a pure, you know, pure this versus that. There's all sorts of combinations here. But listen to these categories and observe, and you can tell the way they're telling the story largely by what you're pulled to do. And when you're pulled to do something which tells you it's a tragedy, when you're pulled to encourage the poor fellow who's trying to make it, when you're pulled to rejoice with the person who's emerging because now they're somebody, when you're pulled to join somebody in the recognition that life is just awful, so why even bother? But yeah, well, we'll just get drunk and go to work anyhow. We've got to make a living. When you're pulled to stay away from being deep because they couldn't handle anything but superficiality. When you're pulled in those ways and you can identify how they're telling their story, point it out. Tell them what it's like to talk with them. Be a mirror. Let that person see how they're approaching life. And if it isn't the fifth way, they're wrong. And they're wrong because it isn't true. I'm not merely a victim coping. I've said that life is tragic, and I believe that. I'm using the word tragedy now in a bit of a different sense. In the middle of life's tragedy, I can live a transcendent drama. In the middle of certain romantic elements, I can live a transcendent drama. In the middle of certain struggles with the irony of life, I can live a transcendent drama. In the middle of life being a comedy in some form, I can live a transcendent drama. That's got to characterize my depths as I go through my life. Point it out to people what you hear. Can you all ponder how you tell your stories? Can you all recognize it? Can you see a little bit of the energy beneath it? Why you tell them that way? There are days I'm into irony all the way. I really am. You know, life doesn't work. Write another book? Sure, why not? It's a living. I'm a very tired man. Not just because of this week, but I've had a stupid fall. I've been gone almost every weekend this entire fall. Please don't hear this as offensive. I don't mean it. I'm really enjoying myself this week. I'm tired. And I'm having a good time teaching, and I mean that. But I've said to myself a couple times in the past month, if I see one more microphone and one more crowd, I'm going to throw up. I've had so many microphones strapped to my chest, so many audiences doing what you're doing, and I want to go, jeez, get away! Look somewhere else. What are you staring at me for? What, am I drooling or something? I mean, when you get tired, you lose your juice and you say, oh, I'll try to pull it off again tonight. Let's see, what will I talk about tonight? I'll do it. Do I care about it? Well, I suppose, I don't know. How many pastors get that way on Sunday morning? And you in the church, if you're sensitive, you recognize it when it comes. How are we telling our stories? We're all in one of these. I'm ironic a lot of the times. There's times I feel very alive and my story becomes a romance. There are times I don't want to talk deep at all. I want my Agatha Christie novel and that's it. And there's a time for that. That's a good thing to do. But stay there and then your life is a comedy. You're a fool just laughing your way through Agatha Christie novels. One more cruise followed by the next cruise. or life is so bad, all you can see is that, well, I'll make it. No, don't feel sorry for me. Oh, no, no, no. Listen to how people tell their stories. As you listen to how people tell their stories, understand that there are three parts to every story. I'm going to introduce this. We're going to take a break in just a minute. There are three parts to every story. And as we sit down to chat with somebody meaningfully, with a passionate conviction as to what our goal is, we're not going to try to solve this person's problems. We're going to try to lift their story into the larger story of God, because finding God is the point, not getting God to solve our problems. That's on our mind as we sit and talk. We're not here to fix something and to soothe something and to get rid of something and to coerce something. We're not here to do that. We're here to encourage movement toward the Lord. That's all there is. And we're not here to diagnose what's causing this problem and why this person is doing that and what dynamics lead to this particular disorder. We're here to understand, given this set of problems, how can I use these problems as a doorway into understanding those things in the soul that are blocking a deeper knowledge of Him, because that's life, knowing Him, and that's all we're consumed with. We want to live. I want to live. So I'm diagnosing not what causes MPD. I'm diagnosing, in an MPD structure, what is going on that is keeping that particular woman, who dissociates so severely, given her miserable history of abuse, what is the structure within her that's keeping her from enjoying God? That's what I want to think about. And with that in my mind, and they make known their problem, I now shift to their story, and I get them to tell their story by being a person who's deeply interested, hopefully, by having my passions right. They begin to tell me their story. I listen to whether their story is a tragic story with a victim, or a romantic story with somebody emerging, or a ironic story with a cynic making it anyhow, or a comedy with a fool laughing. And I listen to these things, and I point it out, and I say, can I tell you how you're coming across? How do you look at life? My opportunities for saying all that to people will come in three spheres, three parts of a person's story. I'll tell you what they are, and we'll break. The three parts of a person's story, and it's real simple. Their present story, what's happening right now in their world of relationships, their inside story, what kind of damage has been done to their soul as life has been lived, and their deepest story, what's going on in their relationship with God, their present, their inside, and their deepest story. What I'm going to suggest to you when we come back from our break is, if you're going to counsel in a way which is going to get you to help, which is going to help you move people toward God and not get you bogged down, you've got to understand that people must talk about their present story first. Until there's some level of conviction of sin about their present relational activity. When they talk about their present story, until there's some level of conviction of sin about their relational activity, then you can move to the inside story with less risk of getting caught up in exploring dynamics in a way which provides excuses for irresponsibility. The framework for exploring dynamics is conviction about present sin. That's why you start with the present story, then go to the inside story, which all become a window and a route to exposing where the action really is, the deepest story of the soul. What is the person doing in their relationship with God? We'll look at all that after a break. See you in a few minutes. Story, there's a present element, an inside element, and a deepest element. And I'm suggesting, just to give you my understanding of a snapshot view of a procedure in counseling, we've thought through our passions, we've thought through our way of thinking in terms of model for discernment, understanding what's going on in the deepest parts of the soul. And now, how do we proceed in the counseling hour? And I'm suggesting that you move from presenting problem to encouraging your client to tell his story, listening to the way he or she tells that story, the five ways we've talked about, encouraging movement toward the fifth way. That's what you're after. That's the way stories should be told as we deal with our lives. In order to move in this direction, we think there needs to be significant disruption and enticement at three levels. Three parts of the story. Now, whenever you reduce something fluid to a system, you lose something. All right? Whenever you reduce something fluid
to a system, you lose something, and you lose something very important. So I'm taking something fluid, a conversation led by the Spirit between two image bearers, and reducing it to a system, so we're going to lose a lot. Three elements in a story. As the person begins telling their story, my suggestion to you is, as a general rule of thumb, don't overhear me. This does not mean every time without fail, but as a general rule of thumb, I think it's wise to begin talking to the person about their present story. Have the person talk about their present story, which essentially consists of their style of relating and their current interactions. What you're wanting to be disruptive with, or what it is that you're wanting to disrupt, you're wanting to disrupt their complacency about the way they relate. Is there a way in which they're failing that produces deep conviction as opposed to intrigue and confusion? Is there a way in which the individual is failing which really smites their soul, which introduces brokenness, where they basically fall on their face in tears of repentance, rather than, you know, that's curious, I think I do that a lot. I wonder what else I might do. That's not disruption. You're just having a uselessly interesting chat. Disruption is when you say, don't you see the impact you're having on this individual? As you did such and such, your impact on that person was really damaging. Now, let me give you an illustration that took place about 2 years ago, and I've mentioned it in a few seminars here and there. It's an illustration, like all illustrations, that can be heard badly out of context, and I hope I can minimize the risk of that. A couple years ago, as I counseled in front of our interns, which I normally do every year, the very first session I had was with a married couple who came in to see me with agreement that they would be videotaped or live video, so the interns in another office could watch while I was chatting with this couple. And they're presenting problems, what they initially began talking about. As I said, how can I help you? That's how I begin all my counseling sessions. How can I help you? I know my purpose. I know my model. I know where I'm heading. But I begin by saying, how can I help you? And they present their problem. The problem was, we're not sure, the man speaking, if we're in our Christian lives growing in the Lord as we want to. And we're recognizing now that with having two little children who are growing up, and they're now 7 and 9 as opposed to little tiny kids, that we're seeing how the world is getting its culture into our children, and we're concerned that we be growing in the Lord so we can properly move toward our kids and inculcate them with Christian values, said the husband. Now he's telling a story. That's his presenting problem, but he's already kind of into his story to some degree. Every presenting problem is part of the story, of course. So as he's talking all that, saying all that, I'm listening. I got some thoughts in my head. And as he's saying that we're not all that close to the Lord and we're concerned with getting the truth of God into our children's brains, I'm listening to the way he's telling the story, and I heard no passion. I heard a very stiff kind of a, tell me the formula so I can do it right so we can get the job done. Everything's basically fine. We just want to grow a little bit. Kind of a stiff, everything's fine, maybe a fool laughing kind of a mood. That's how I'm listening to him. I watch his wife as he's talking, and she's not with him. It's just clear that she's just doing this. Well, you got to pick up on that. So I said to him, I said, as you're talking, tell me what's happening in your wife. And he goes, and I said, did that question require you to change the channel in your mind? And I said, well, yeah, a little bit. I was kind of going over here. I said, well, change the channel and see what you can do with it. So he, what were you thinking? She said, oh, just, you know, we're concerned that we really need to go in the Lord and help our children become better Christians. All right, now you're hearing the story. And I said to him, I forget the wording, this is 2 years ago, but I'm getting to the point that I do recall clearly, so I'm kind of making up some of it till I get there.
it's close.
But I said to him something along the line of, you know, tell me what you're feeling as you say all this to me. And he kind of says, well, I'm just concerned. And I said, as you tell me this, I just don't feel much coming out of you. I feel like what you'd be happy with if I responded to would be giving you some kind of a, you know, three steps that have devotions every morning and make sure you pray with your kids every night, and that'll work. And I said, that's the kind of thing I hear you pulling from me. You know, let's keep it light. Let's keep it shallow. Let's not get into anything heavy. Tell me, when do you feel things really deeply? I'm talking to a man who's talking and telling a story in a comedy kind of a role, a fool laughing, and I'm wanting to take him down into a deeper level. But I'm concerned to hear his present story with his wife. That's where I want to get, to present story, and I want to hear how there's failure going on somewhere in this dyad of these two people so I can do something. And we spent the next hour, after I introduced this thought of his feeling deeply about something, we spent the next hour asking the question, where do you feel really deeply? And where his mind went to was with his parents, who had come to visit them just maybe a month or so ago. And he said that when mom and dad come, I always feel so empty when they're visiting with our family. And when they left, they left in a very kind of typical way. There was no expression of anything between us. And we've never said anything between us. We never touched. There's never any meaningful talking. We just kind of stayed at a superficial level. And he's talking about this for the whole hour. And he said, and then mom and dad drove off, and I just kind of felt kind of crummy. And I began pushing a bit, and I said, what do you mean crummy? I wonder what crummy means. My guess is that was real hard on you. And as we talked a little more about it, I came up with an image, and I recall using it with this gentleman, an image I've used with a number of people. I said, it seems to me, as you describe your family, as I've gotten some picture for your home life with your mom and dad, good people who provided well, who were always there, but who never connected with you, it seems to me like it's like coming into a dining room, to the kitchen table, to the dining table, and there on the dining room table is wonderful china with linen napkins and perfect goblets, and everything's just set perfectly in the centerpiece, and everything's wonderful. Tablecloth is elegant. Everything's great, but there's no food. And when I said that, I saw him feel something when I said no food. And so I pushed him that, and I said, what did you feel as I said that? And he said, well, that's kind of hard. I said, what did you feel when they walked out, when they left and got back in the car? And as I began pushing along that line after about an hour of counseling, he broke down and cried. I don't think that when a person cries, you've hit pay dirt. I've said that before. But he cried. For whatever reason, he cried. And when he cried, what I noticed was as soon as he cried, his wife, who this whole conversation was kind of, you know, just kind of anxiously kind of looking and interested sometimes and wanting to go somewhere else and holding her mouth shut at great effort, when he cried, she immediately reached over very solicitously and put her hands on his elbow. Just reached over and, oh. Now, is that a good or a bad thing to do? Could be either, couldn't it? There could be a time, many of you wives have husbands who've cried and you've reached out and touched them and it's been wonderful. I think that can be a great thing. It all depends on what your energy. And as I watched her touch him, I noticed that as he felt her hand on his elbow, it seemed to me that there was just no response of kind of a moving toward her or a patting her, thanks, hon, or there was nothing like that. There was more, I thought, of kind of a stiffening. And so I picked up on it and I said, tell me what you felt when your wife touched you. And he said very quickly and very firmly, condescended to. So I turned to her and began talking to her for the first time in the hour, really, and said, tell me what's going on inside of you when you reached out and touched your husband. I'm dealing with her present story. I'm looking to disrupt something. Because in her mind, she was just touching her husband, you know, just because she cared, and that's what she said. Well, he was crying, I just wanted to touch him. And I said, your intention was then to encourage him. Well, yes. He wasn't encouraged, he felt condescended to. What do you want to do with that? 15 minutes later, what we came up with was here's a man who was so angry, particularly at his mother, that he had shut her out absolutely. And all his phone calls home, dad never got on the phone, mother always did, and he talked on the phone about the most trivial thing, a fool laughing, just a comedy of a life, nothing deep, all superficial, and he was shutting her out and stiffening his soul against how much he longed for a different relationship with his folks and how much he was hurting because it wasn't there. And what came out after some probing
was that her reaching over and touching her husband was her way of saying, I am so furious at you for the way you've shut your mother out and the way you have shut me out. I'm terrified you're going to continue to do that. This is the first time I've ever seen you cry in about 10 years of marriage, and I'm going to find some way to keep the juice flowing, and I'm going to get it toward me. By the end of that hour, she was disrupted. She sat there and said, is that what I did? And I said, well, I don't question whether I'm right or wrong. You tell me, is that what you did? And she said, I am so mad at that man for shutting me out. I'm so determined to get this guy to come through for me. What's your style of relating? What's the energy? The wasp is walking as you touch your husband's shoulder. That's disrupting. I fail. Now, when you're working with a believer, and several have asked me, I made the comment about working with unbelievers. Will I cover that? No, the seminar is going to be very incomplete in a whole lots of areas. That'll be one of them. But in dealing with a believer, particularly, clearly at least, when that woman is able to see what she really has been doing toward her husband by reaching out and touching his arm, and she really is just wanting to get something that has much less to do with using her femininity to be an encouragement and much more manipulating to get a response for her own soul, as she begins to really be smitten by that, in a believer, something deeper is going to surface. If the Spirit of God lives within her, there's a better energy in her heart than manipulation. And you begin to say things like, is that how you want to live your life with your man? Is that what you really want to do? Is there anything else in you? As you see your husband hurting over a difficult relationship with his parents, I can hear you hurting real badly. I understand that. But in your hurt, you're justifying your manipulation because you're hurt so badly. In your hurt, all you can see is your own pain and what you're trying to get from him. Is there anything else going on inside of you? Press it, and you're enticing something, because what comes out, and what took a while to come out but is there, is there really is a longing to give. If you're a Christian, you're stained just like me. You're not in heaven. You're still sinful. But it really can be said that there is something good that's in the core of your being, just like there is in mine. The Lord's within me by His Spirit. I am a new creature. I do have a new heart. And the longings that are deeply good that come from the Spirit of God begin to surface in the presence of conviction that results from all the disruption of facing the way you really relate. Begin talking about the person's present story. Look for those things that reflect the operation of the energy of Cain. Look for the way in which there is a, I hate me, but I really hate you because I need you because God isn't much. And all you're picking on so far is, I'm doing something right now with you that violates the final commandment to love God and as a result, to love others. You're looking for some violation of that, which you can catch them in the act of, to produce the kind of disruption that can surface the longings that you can then entice. The present story. As the present story gets told, never completely, but as the present story gets told, and now there's a framework of conviction. Now there's a framework of saying, what I'm really after, what I'd like to learn how to do, is to use my femininity, my masculinity, my soul, my gifts, my talents, my time. What I would really like to do is I'd like to have a good impact on people. I really would. And what's blocking me is not something external to me. It's not my husband, my wife, my friends, my pastor. What really is blocking me from moving toward people in a good way is something in me that's just awful. Whatever this wasp thing is, it's a mess, and I've been beating it, and it's still walking. Something's wrong with me. Well, I'd like to be different. I long to give. When a person begins to understand that, then you can shift down to the next part of the story. Our inside story. I'll go up here. Our inside story. The story of how you've been damaged. The story of how self has interacted with world that has led to a lot of fear and terror and discouragement and ways in which we really have been failed, and all of us have been failed by life. We've been failed by individuals. We need to start facing the fact that we've been failed. The story I told last night about the woman who came in to give me a big hug and then walked out to her husband who rebuked her for being spontaneous. And as she told me how it was so hard, she first began by saying, "It's my fault." And I said, "No, that's just self-contempt. That's covering over anger towards your husband as that got dealt with." My next sentence was, as we were moving into an inside story, "That's been a pattern of your life. There's never been anybody who has recognized the legitimacy of your spontaneity. You've been failed. Talk about other people in your life. Let's talk about your inside story of where there's been damage." Now, what's the great danger in doing this? Well, all the right-wing conservatives who attack, who are the anti-counseling types, here's where they start talking with some concern that's legitimate. You start talking about inside factors and background factors and all that, and pretty soon you're excusing sin. I read in U.S. News and World Report, there was some judge who just got arrested, and I forget where it was, for some sort of sexual harassment, and a psychiatrist at a major university wrote an article saying, "How dare we try this man as though he were a criminal? Don't we realize he's suffering from a certain disease that comes out of DSM-3, the psychiatric diagnostic book, and it's a thing called erotomania." And the whole thought was, because of certain damage in his childhood, he has this hunger that he can't control, and therefore the fact that he's harassed women really needs to be treated as opposed to be punished. I think that's an awful model. I don't want to encourage that at all. That's why, in my own thinking, I insist on dealing with the present story until conviction becomes a category for understanding whatever else gets talked about. That's why I never recommend you start off with exploring a person's past. And if you've got 20 sessions with a person, and I'm making this up now, let's see if I can come close to what I really think. If you've got 20 sessions with a person, 20 hours, and you spend 18 of them dealing with the person's inside story, my guess is you're not doing a very biblical job. You spend most of your time talking about background and damage and dynamics and all that. You spend most of your time there, and my guess is that you're really encouraging people in a direction that's illegitimate. You've got to spend most of your time in the first story and the third story. But the inside story has a place. How has there been damage? Where have I been failed? Where, when I was a little girl who swirled around in my party dress and Dad just walked off in disgust, that was damaging, that was abusive. And it's right to face that and to admit that. Dad was wrong for that. Now, we don't know what happened to Dad. Maybe he just got fired from his job that day. Or maybe he's just a real mean guy. But whatever, whether we understand that he was troubled or he's just a mean guy, either way, to a five-year-old girl, that's pretty damaging. She needs to face the fact that there's something in her soul that went into hiding at that point. I've been failed, I've been damaged, and as myself interacts with my world to find life, believing that's where life is, there's no God relevant to my life, and when I've been failed, and my spontaneity, my desire just to kind of run out and say, "Hi, Daddy, look at my new pretty dress," when that was rejected and put down, then little girl learned something. She learned to take the spontaneous, lovely parts of her soul that legitimately longed to be enjoyed and to stick them somewhere where nobody could see them, and to kill them. A lot of women don't enjoy being women for reasons precisely that have to do with that. And as you begin facing the way you've been failed and the way it was so hard when this person, when that person did this, when as a little boy you were rowdy and you were pulled out of the boys' room and little girl dancing around and Daddy just walked off and ignored you. As you begin to face the immensity of the pain that you feel in your soul and you felt ever since you were little and all the way up through all your life, as you begin to face the immensity of pain in your soul and you're disrupted by that, something's going to surface. A deep, legitimate longing to be alive the way you really are. you'd like is to come alive and to be. And that woman who touched her husband on the elbow and began to see how manipulative she was, my next sentence was not, "That's awful, stop it." My next sentence was, "Where has anybody really not shut you out? Tell me about your background." We went to the inside story. She told me lots of stories about how, in her background, she just was always valued for her efficiency. Nobody ever noticed how much she longed for certain things. Nobody ever pulled out the deepest part of her soul that wanted to be enjoyed and prized. And I've said, "You've been failed. You must grieve over your own soul and the way you've been failed." And in the middle of that comes a longing to be. Now, without the context of the present story, I say again, without that context, what will you be encouraging if you just deal with the inside story and develop a longing to be? You'll be encouraging somebody to tell their story as a romance. Nothing matters more than my coming to be. And my sentence is, "Oh no, that isn't it. What matters is your coming to be so you can be a part of God's plan in a richer way. And you can give more because you've already established you long to give. We want to lift your story up into the bigger story of God. Something far more important is going on than just you becoming all you can be so you can feel good about yourself and have the life you want." That's a romance in the bad sense of that word. And as the person becomes aware of their longing to give, and they're longing to be, how are they going to feel? How many of you, don't raise your hands, but ponder it, how many of us, are you aware of how much we long to give? We really don't want to hurt our friends, and we do. We really do fail. We reach out and touch our husbands and touch our wives and touch our friends in ways that are very self-centered, very manipulative, and we realize how badly we fail. We're very disrupted by that. We long to give. We really do. We don't make any progress. Doesn't seem. And so we figure, well, we'll go into therapy. And understand the inside story, and we come up with lots of insights about all the ways we've been failed, and we start facing a lot of things we never saw before in our lives. But we don't feel like we come alive in ways that give. And we end up, after telling our present stories and our inside stories and making them clear, we end up feeling very powerless to really change the way we want to change. And so therefore, we lower our standards so we can keep them. Rather than lowering our standards and getting by as people who seem a little more together and a little kinder, we want to become real lovers. We want to deeply give, alive with all that we are, so we can pour it into other people in order to become the kind of husband you really want to become, the kind of friend you really want to become, the kind of parent and wife and that you really want to become. You've got to start telling your deepest story. You must start telling your deepest story having to do with your relationship with God. Your deepest story, which begins to surface the fact that when you reached out and touched your husband's arm when he cried, there was something in you that reacted out of sheer terror. There was a panic because his tears made you aware of how lonely you feel, and you felt like your very life depended on getting this guy to treat you a little bit better. It's been 10 years of a nothing marriage. And as you watch this man cry, you realize you would like to get the benefit of his passion moving toward you, and that would spell life, because you've never had passion moving toward you. You think about your background, and your parents were propositionally abandoning you, the language of last night. And you begin to face all that, and you realize you want so much to be alive, you want so much to give, but what's really happening as you move toward your husband, what you're really saying as you reach out and touch your husband's elbow with your hand, what you're doing at the same time or even before is turning to God and clenching your fist and saying, "You're not giving me life, so I'm going to get him to. Now help me." Come on! You're not doing anything for me. I've been to Sunday school for years. Never felt life. And you begin to realize that in the middle of your touching your husband's elbow, what you're really saying is, God, you're not much. Oh, I sing the hymns, but they've never reached into my soul. I'm not sure if you're all that good. And that leaves me so alone and terrified in a world where there's no one where I can rest. I'm so angry. I don't trust. And as that begins to reduce you to repentance, as that realization begins to break your heart, your redeemed heart, as you realize what you're really saying to God, and it violates something in you, because you know at the core of your being, you really do love Him. You owe Him your life. He's your Savior. He's your Lord. He's your hope. He's your King. He's your comfort. He's everything to you. And yet what you're doing in your interaction with your husband is you're telling him he's not very good. And you're living in total terror and demanding this man come through for you. You really don't trust. Folks, when you face that, that's very, very disruptive. When I face what I really do with God, it's very, very disruptive. For one thing, I've got to appear at the judgment seat. What am I doing with God? Whatever city I build down here, God's going to take all the bricks and cinder blocks that I use to build my city down here, going to put in the pile and going to call it wood, hay, and stubble, burn it up. And I'm going to suffer eternal loss. The issues are big. Am I really saying that about God? I'm really not trusting Him? And when something in your heart says, Lord, that's awful. I'm so glad that you forgive me. Without that, what would I have? Then something in you is going to walk through the door of grace that provides you forgiveness into the throne room, and your longing to rest in the very character of God is going to move you in deeper worship toward Him that comes out of your brokenness. A longing to give, a longing to be, and a longing to rest that can all be enticed, pulled forth, affirmed, nourished, strengthened through a singing of a hymn, strengthened as you hear a Bible verse, strengthened as you hear a good sermon, strengthened as you hear somebody encourage you to move towards your husband differently, and you say, that's what I want to do. I really want to give to Him. And I want to give to Him with all that I am as a woman. But the reason I can't do that, or the reason I haven't done it, is because I don't think God is very good, given what happened to me when I was a little girl, and I was ignored, and I was abandoned, and I was molested, and I was done this to, and all these terrible things. Other than terror and rage, I've defined life as somebody giving to me the opposite of what my father gave to me, and my husband's the only candidate, because God, He let it all happen, so He's not very good. So come on, husband, I'll touch your arm, make it happen! Something inside of you says, man, that's not what I want. And you live a shattered life for a while, and you're broken on your face, and you're crying, and you're weeping, and you're repenting. And then somehow you become aware that the Lord's not up there scolding and screaming and saying, for crying out loud. He's saying, I knew what I got when I got you. It wasn't much, but you're mine. I put something good in you, and it's there. Come on, dry your eyes. Lift your eyes. Look at me. I'm smiling. Everything's all right. You're forgiven. You're my kid. I think you're pretty. You can rest in me. Everything's all right. Future's going to be fine. But Lord, I'm making a mess of my life. Yeah, I agree with that. Well, what are you going to do about it? Well, I'm just very patient. It's all been forgiven. I'm working with you. When all that starts coming out, I would suggest that you become surprised over time by the reality of the Spirit of God working in your heart. You begin to develop what I can give very feeble testimony to. You begin to develop a new sense of affection for Christ you've never had before. You begin to find yourself just wanting to talk to Him. You begin to actually think of enjoying Him as opposed to
Lord, give me. You begin to think of no matter what goes wrong, he's still good, and the trust starts to develop, and you wonder how it got there, and you just praise God. It got there, I suggest, through the process of disruption and affirmation as you honestly told your story. As clients tell their stories, as friends tell their stories, as we tell our stories to one another, our present, our inside, and our deepest story, my job with you as you tell your story is to be the kind of person that will encourage you to tell your story with no holds barred. I don't want you being careful as you tell me your story. I don't want you screaming as you tell me your story. And you will scream if you notice that I'm a harsh kind of a guy. You will scream if you notice that I'm the kind of guy that can be pretty easily upset and terrified when things get said that are tough. But you'll have comfort in telling me your story freely if you believe somehow that my energy toward you is one that really is compassionate, is one that no matter how bad you are, no matter what's going wrong with your life, that I can handle it because I have confidence not in me, not in you, but in God. And as I help you tell your story, and as you tell it richly, reading my passion correctly, hopefully, and tell your story with a deep connection between the two of us, with the courage of being open and honest, I want you to tell your story until your present, your inside, your deepest story, I want you to tell your story until you're silenced by mystery. I want you to tell your story until the issues are bigger than you can handle. The sin within you cannot be explained. You don't understand it. Oh, you go back to Genesis and you understand theologically how the whole thing started to some degree, and you realize that Eve said God isn't good and Adam said God isn't good enough, and maybe you buy into that particular thought. You study the doctrine of sin in the Bible and you realize that the wasp is there and you get your own theology of sin. But the mystery remains and you just realize, oh, wretched man that I am. And you're silenced. You don't go figuring it out. You just plead with the Almighty. You're silenced by the mystery of your sin. You're silenced by the mystery of life as you tell your inside story. How come I got born into this family? How come my college roommate had this wonderful dad and mom, and my dad's an alcoholic, and my mom has had four husbands since? How do you figure all this? And then my girlfriend, who had these wonderful parents, meets this wonderful guy, and then he turns out to be a homosexual with AIDS. And you go, yum. And pretty soon, you have the wisdom to stop asking questions. Oh, ask questions that are hard for a long time. The smartest thing Job ever did, the best part of the book of Job, is when it said, thus endeth the words of Job. And then God comes and does what? Provide answers? No, he said, I'll ask the questions around here. I'll speak, you answer me. That's different. You're silenced by Ecclesiastes. It makes no sense. Life is chasing after the wind. I've got my degree. I've written my books. I have my seminars. What's it all about? Am I chasing after wind? Is there any way to find meaning in this world? Well, I'll tell you this. It's not by writing another book. It's by having a passion for God that might motivate writing another book. But boy, is that different. A lot of us. There's a mystery about life. You can't figure it out. There's a mystery about sin. You can't figure it out. And there's certainly a mystery about God. A mystery about sin in your present story. A mystery about life in your deepest, in your inside story. A mystery about God in your deepest story. God, you're inscrutable. I don't understand what you're up to. Dad will mention this tomorrow morning, perhaps, but his father died when he was 5 years old. What's a five-year-old think when his father's taken after his mother has said consistently, let's trust the Lord, he'll get better? Good words of faith from a trusting woman. And then when he died, her faith didn't stop. Her faith continued, we'll continue to trust the Lord. He'll provide. What's a five-year-old think? God? That's my daddy?
trust the Lord, you'll get better. Good words of faith from a trusting woman. And then when he died, her faith didn't stop. Her faith continued. We'll continue to trust the Lord. He'll provide. What's a five-year-old think? God? That's my daddy? You tell me that makes sense to a five-year-old. Tell me that makes sense to a 30-year-old. Tell me how that made sense to Dan a year and a half ago. Tell me how it makes, how it's going to make sense to Stephanie Coker if she loses her dad. God, what are you up to? He's so unpredictable. Maturity is finding his unpredictability delightful. Because he's up to something good. Just doesn't look that way. Tell the story until you're silenced by the mystery of sin, by the mystery of life, by the mystery of God. And then when you're silenced, having asked your questions, then you come before God and you're quiet enough to hear his whisper. Because you're coming to him now, not desperate to figure out the code, to crack the code. How do I get over sin so I can do better? What's the formula? All right, a five-day conference, that'll do it. How do I get over my damage? 12 steps, that'll do it. How do I get to know God a little more deeply? I'll find some way. Regular church attendance, some form of legalism, that'll do it. And you realize, no, it won't do it. You're silenced. You're out of answers. You're out of questions. You're just quiet. You're desperate. You're still. When does God speak? Has God at that point whispered just a little bit to you once in a while? It does to me, not much, but it's growing. Help people to tell their stories. You're looking to disrupt and affirm. As they tell their stories, listen to how they're telling it. Romantically? Tragically? Ironically? Comically? Or transcendently? As they tell their stories, tell their current story, their present story, about how they relate to people, how they put their hand on husband's arms, for reasons to manipulate and to maneuver, because life has to be found in you because God isn't doing much. I've got to get you to do it. Oh, that is sinful, isn't it? Gee, I want to be a better wife. I wonder why you aren't that way. Maybe it's your background. Okay, tell your background story. Tell your inside story. Well, mother and dad never this, and my parents never this, and something else happened over here, and I guess everybody was damaged, and I was let down, and I would long to be more who I really am. I want to be released to be who I really am, so I can sin less and love more. I really want that. And I guess the real issues, when I think about it, are the fact that I'm not all that crazy about God. I don't trust him very much. Oh, I really don't like that. Oh, Lord, I'm so confused. God, there's a mystery here. I'm desperate for you. Him that cometh to God must believe that he exists and that he is the rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Why do you diligently when you're silenced by mystery and you're desperate for hope? All you have is him. Then you come. I want to spend a few minutes illustrating something of what I mean by telling you a little bit of my story. My present, my inside, and my deepest story. There's a midpoint of appropriateness when a public speaker shares his life. Too often, public speakers, people in the spotlight, pastor Sunday morning, seminar leaders like me. Too often, as Dan mentioned in his Wednesday night address, we tell about our problems that are past tense. And that's a mistake. I think we ought to be open about the fact that problems are present tense. But then we can go to the other extreme and tell too much. There are some things nobody should say in public. There are some things only my brother can hear as I share my secrets. Only one-on-one. I have certain things I've told one person in my life and nobody else.
That's going to stay that way. I'm not going to tell you about that tonight. I'm going to tell you a little bit. Try to give you some field to illustrate, not to exhibit me, but to illustrate something of the points that I'm trying to make. Let me tell you one element of my present story. If I tell you one element of my present story, I want you to hear what my wasp is, what my ruling passion is, as I move through life. There's a strong sense in which I've become very persuaded in the last 2 or 3 months that my ruling passion as I relate to people in my present life, whether it's speaking to an audience or talking to my wife or chatting with a friend or leading a small group or being involved in a small group or meeting somebody in the elevator, part of my ruling passion is this. I must have something to say. I must have something to say. And I go looking for it. How do I measure whether I have something to say? Well, by your response. I wonder why it is that I'm very sensitive to people's responses. I wonder why it is that I can't help it. Thoughts go flitting through my mind, even as I teach tonight. Wonder how I'm doing. Dan and I were chatting this the other day, and both of us are feeling like we've, this will sound crass, forgive it, we were losing whatever ability we had of reading our audiences. I've had talks where I thought they were as flat and dull as could be, and people have responded with, boy, was that powerful. I'm going, what? Other times I thought, man, was God with me. People said, well, that was all right. What do you mean, all right? Why am I caught up with all that? What's my style of relating? What's a ruling passion within me? How do I fail? I must have something to say, and so I put pressure on others to confirm that I've said it well. That's not giving to you. That's failing you. I must have something to say. Present story. Let me tell you a few elements of my inside story, things that are beneath the surface of my ruling passion. When I was in third grade, again, forgive us if it sounds boastful. I said that Monday night when I told some stories. There's no boasting here, I don't think, but it might sound it to you. When I was in third grade, I made A's all the way through in third grade. Never got a B in third grade. And there was some recommendation that I skip to fourth grade. So there was consultation and testing and whatever, whether I skipped to fourth grade, and the decision was made that I should not skip to fourth grade. I almost skipped to fourth grade. What that does is somebody has to have something to say. In eighth grade, I belonged to the National Honor Society. They gave an award every year to the eighth grade student who was the most promising National Honor Society scholar. The Merit Award, I think it was called. I was up for it. I was the alternate. Ricky Fleece got it. Strange how names come back to you. I almost won the National Honor Society Merit Award in eighth grade. In eighth grade, I think it was, maybe ninth, I tried out for the football team. The coach said one day, I'm a pretty fair athlete, the coach said on what, about the third or fourth day of practice, all you eighth graders, it was an eighth grader, all you eighth graders, I want you to get in a race, and the ones that come in first and second will be starters on the JV team. I came in first. You know who came in second? Ricky Fleece. The next day I quit the football team. Ricky went on to become a star end. I almost became a star football player. What happens inside of me? I must have something to say. I wonder if I have it. I almost. And then in graduate school, I graduated first in my class. Not second. Wish Ricky would have been second. Love to know what he's doing today. First article I ever wrote that wanted to get published got published.
What happens inside somebody with a ruling passion of living up to the child of promise? Must have something to say. I almost here. I did there. You live in chronic internal terror because your life depends on making it, but you almost do. And then you do. Then you almost do. Then you do. How'd this talk go? How'd that talk go? Pastors, do you agree with me? When you get up Sunday morning, you never know what's going to happen. Have you gotten to that point? If you've gotten to that point, I think you're maturing. If you know what's going to happen, then you're just preaching in the flesh and you happen to have some good oratorical skills. I was so impressed 8-10 years ago when Buck Hatch from Columbia Bible College, I heard him tell the story. He's one of the most gracious, self-effacing men that I met. And he said this once in my presence. He said that I was once speaking to an audience and midway through I stopped and I said, "The Spirit has gone from me. I have nothing to say to you." And he sat down. And I remember listening to that and saying, I haven't got a clue when the Spirit's involved in what I'm doing. I wouldn't know when he left because I'd never sent him a present. But I speak pretty good. I can handle an audience. The audience is getting bored. Tell a joke. Hey, I'm pretty good at that. Spirit's not involved, but I'm a pretty good speaker. I must have something to say, and I've been able to pull it off all my life pretty well. I'm a pretty smart guy. A couple months ago, lying in the bathtub, that's where all my insights come, occurred to me that's the driving passion of my life. I must have something to say. I almost, and I did. Then I almost, then I did. You go back and forth. My deepest story, a few elements from that, somewhat scattered, but might help you see the point. I think I've always been aware of something bigger than me is going on. I owe that to my parents. Mother's been very involved when I was growing up in camps and craft projects, and I went with her to a variety of camps where she was involved in craft projects, and I always had the sense that she was doing it not just because she enjoyed it, which she did, she's very talented in those areas, she was doing something that was bigger than her. Very impressed with that. Very impressed with watching my father pray when I was a kid. I told you this before. It always struck me when I watched him pray that he thought he was talking to somebody. I remember being puzzled by that. He was closing his eyes and thinking, who's everybody talking to around here? 5-year-old kid looking up at him at a Lord's Supper praying. I'm going, he's got his eyes closed. Dear Lord. And I'm going, who's that? You know, there's Mr. Herman. There's Mr. Dunbar. Who's dear Lord? You know, oh, it's God. Well, that's just a word. He doesn't think so. Something's bigger going on. My deepest story, something's bigger going on. If I'm going to be a part of it, I better have something to say. That doesn't work. That's how I've lived a lot of my life. When I was young, I'm not sure how old, 10, 12, 13, we were on the way to camp in New York, in the mountains of New York, Word of Life. We stopped at a hotel the night before. We got there a day before our lodging was available to camp, and we were in a little hotel with 2 rooms, Mom and Dad over here, and Bill and I in this room with bunk beds. I was in the top bunk, Bill was in the bottom, and I was maybe, I don't know, 12, 13. Looked out the window, mountains of New York, upper New York. There was a lake, and there were the big pine trees, and the moon was coming down. And I remember as clear as a bell saying to myself, maybe for the first time, it's a big world out there, and I fit somewhere. Always been aware of something bigger. Sense of transcendence. So how do I fit? Oh, I know. I wrote the best paper in 8th grade. I was teacher of the year, University of Illinois. I know how I fit. I must have something to say. Do I? Oh my gosh. I'll study hard. I'll think hard. I'll get it. There's joy for you. There's peace. There's love. There's humility. About 10 years ago, longer than that maybe, we were vacationing in the west coast of Florida in the Gulf. Got up at midnight and walked out on the pier. And I had a book or two published by then, maybe 12, 15 years ago. I lose track of time. I had a book or two published and was getting some seminars going. People were coming, and I had a practice that was thriving, and I was getting known in my area. I stood in that pier for about 20, 30 minutes and screamed at God, "Why are you putting me in a position where people are asking me to have something to say? I'm not sure if I do. You jolly well better give me something to say. Because I must have something to say. Every time I speak, I must. God, I can't trust you. I cannot trust you to fulfill my agenda because you don't always give me something to say. I don't trust you. That leaves me alone. Leaves me mad. Well, I got a good mind. I'll figure it out. I'll put together good stuff. I wonder how many people get by like that. I have for years. And as I tell my story, what I'm aware of is there's a lot of disruption in my life. Because when your present story is full of this ruling passion of a need to have something to say, when somebody else has it better, you get jealous. When somebody else exposes where you haven't thought very well, you get defensive. And it messes up your fellowship and your joy, and you become a source of disunity in the body of Christ. And you don't like that. You get disrupted by that. And something inside of you surfaces and you realize how much you long to give. I don't want to disrupt the body of Christ. I don't want to be jealous. I don't want to be competitive. I want to say whatever God gives me to say. You say whatever God gives you to say. You're a part of the body. I'm a part of the body. I've got gifts. You got gifts. Let's get together and give, and the body will grow as each joint gives what it has to supply. That's what I want, but I'm so stuck with this miserable ruling passion of mine. I want to swear. Then my deepest or my inside story, I get so disrupted by how anxious I am to do well. Will I do well? I almost did this. I almost won that award. I did win that one. It happens sometimes. Will it happen this time? And my soul is just anxious a lot. What's going to happen this time? I don't want to be like that. You know my prayer for the last several months, I've told you several times this week, Lord, release me to be. I long to give to my audience this week. I really do. I don't want to have something to say. I want to say something. I wonder what God wants to say, and maybe I can be useful. That's what I long for. I don't want to get up here and be who I'm not. I want to just be me. Can I tell you a secret? That's one of the reasons why I'm sitting all week. Because when I stand, I tend to reach. When I sit, I feel a little more relaxed. Someone told me this week that they were here 2 years ago, and they said, you're putting less pressure on us this time than you did last time. And I said, praise the Lord. I had very little to do with that. But maybe he's growing me a bit. I'm disrupted by how petty and jealous and competitive I am. But I've got to have something to say. I long just to give. I'm disrupted by how anxious I am. Am I going to make it this time? Will I get the award or will I lose it? I got it that time. I didn't get it this time. I'm disrupted by all that. I just want to be. I want to be whoever I am. You know what? I don't like being Dr. Crabb, but I sure like being Larry sometimes. You know the Christian community chews up its leaders. Those of us who are in that kind of a position, and I'm there, have to fight with all our lives to not be chewed up. Folks, don't chew up your pastor. Don't chew him up. Don't require him to be who he's not. He's just a guy. He's got bad breath while he's preaching, probably. He cut the sermon short, not because the Spirit led him. He had to go to the bathroom. Let him be who he is. And I'm disrupted by how sometimes I feel so angry and disappointed in God. How on earth can I be disappointed in somebody who died for me? That disrupts me. I don't like that. I long to give him the glory and to rest in my confidence in his character. Are you disrupted? Do you long? Live there. God will do his work in your life. The more he does his work in your life, the more something in your soul is going to want to sing. Stand with me. Sing a closing hymn.